Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is poet Rich Ferguson. His latest collection is titled Everything is Radiant Between the Hates. Rich, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
This is a meaty collection of poetry. And I don't want to rat out any particular poets, but a lot of times when you get a book of, you know, a person's poetry, it's a little bit on the light side.
Right.
This is a big collection of poetry. Did you just save up everything and then just put it out there?
In a way, yes. It's definitely, you know, you're the second person actually to say this, and probably the last week, someone who just was commenting on the size of the collection. And just
and I'm not complaining. By the way, I'm not complaining. I find that good.
No. Yeah. No, I take it as a compliment. But yeah, I was actually writing a number of those poems after my first collection, Eighth in Agony, which was released on Punk Hostage Press, goodness, about 7 years ago or so. And, you know, the collection went through a number of incarnations, and there were times where I thought it was ready, and then I would put it aside. And I perform a lot, well, you know, prior to COVID, I perform a lot live. And so that was kind of getting me through, you know, that's sort of my creative fix. So I didn't feel the need that I had to put another collection into the world. I was happy to wait until it felt right. And, you know, it just, it kept evolving, and then COVID hit, and then I was writing new stuff related to that. So yeah, it was definitely a work that was created over time. And I think in this situation, the extra time served me well.
It's an amazing collection. Now, and we're, again, to reiterate, we're talking about Everything is Radiant Between the Hates. There are essentially, would you call them chapters or sections that have titles like Worry Beads and Blessings in the Gomorrah of Glamour and Gimme All You Can. Talk to me about how you form these subsections. And I'm asking like I would ask any visual artist too.
Right.
Are you writing specific poems for a section, or do you just do a mess of poems and then you go, okay, this goes here, this goes here, this goes here?
That's a really good question, actually. And as far as whether I would call them chapters or sections.
Yeah.
I don't know. Either one. You know, prior to releasing this collection, I actually did write a novel. So, you know, that.
And I want to ask you about that in a little bit, because hilarious. Yeah. It's hilarious reading the description of that novel.
Yeah, but sections or chapters, I think, is a good way to put it. When I think you kind of nailed it. When in the beginning, I think I was just writing a bunch of poems.
Okay.
And then when it came to starting to put a collection together, I sort of laid everything out and kind of tried to see different through lines and how certain poems might fit together. And then once I sort of got the bones of that, the skeleton of that together, then it became clearer to me what I was kind of going for. And then at that point, I think I started writing certain poems to fit within those sections.
Okay, that makes
sense. But I kind of had to feel around
those
sections.
That makes total sense to me. And also, it's interesting because there are a lot of similarities between a visual artist and other written artists, like novelists, doing the same thing, putting all these things in sort of that they work together. Do you see a flow from the beginning to the end, too?
Yeah.
And that's got to be a whole other artistry, being able to create that flow.
Yes. And, you know, my publisher, Eric Morago,
I've talked to Eric.
Oh, great. Yeah. I love Eric so much. You know, I had originally, you know, as I had said before, the collection went through many different versions and everything. And then there were times where I thought it was ready and it wasn't ready. And I eventually got to a point where I didn't know what to do, that I just hit a wall. And I had heard that Eric was doing a lot of freelance editing work in addition to running Moontide Press. And so I kind of thought I would hit him on, not, you know, just sort of approach him on those two different levels, you know, to hire him as a freelance editor, but to also get to gain his insights as a publisher. And so when I presented the collection to him as an editor, he was like, you know, he had very few line edits and stuff. And he was like, you know, I think this is really cool. I like it a lot. And then I said to him, well, you know, I was kind of fishing, and I said, well, you know, are there any publishers that you could recommend?
oh, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, I would sort of, you know, there was intention in doing this on my end, and I was hoping, you know, and the turnout was, you know, what I was hoping for. And I said, you know, are there any publishers that you think might be interested in something like this? And Eric said, I'm hesitant to recommend another publisher because I would actually like to publish. And I was like, yes.
The plan worked.
Exactly. It kind of did. Yeah. So what we ended up doing after that, that was kind of the phase. I would say we worked on it for a number of months after that, where he kind of suggested to me, why don't you play around with the structure a bit, you know, move some poems around, see how it feels. And that was where a lot of, I had moved some poems around prior to that, but that was definitely now that I knew that, like, I had a home for the book and things were starting to come into shape. That was definitely a time where I really started to be a lot more intentional with how the poems were going to stack up, not only within each section, but kind of, as you were saying before, how to make the whole thing a journey from beginning to end.
Right.
So it was like layer upon layer upon layer.
Yeah. And it works. And I want to compliment you on that. It's funny because a lot of these collections of poetry, you sort of dip into and dip back out. But I read this from beginning to the end and there was a flow to it.
And, oh, thank you.
And it was great. But I want to get back to something you were talking about before.
Yeah.
About performing poetry. Because when I was reading these, I literally had a vision of you standing up on stage and performing them. There's something about their structure. There's your love of alliteration. Talk to me about you in performance of poetry. Did you always write poetry for performance?
Well, that's actually a really good question. I'll tell you, I've loved writing since a very young age. So, and I think I've always,
well, you know, let's start with that, Rich.
Okay.
Talk to me about your first poetry. Like, what age are you? And I want to find out when you're comfortable calling yourself a poet.
That's a really good question.
So talk to me. I mean, were you one of these kids that are writing poetry? You know, most of us do it as a chore in school. Talk to me when you were like, I want to write a poem.
Yeah, well, I was always really drawn to just writing in general way back in like third grade or whatever. I always loved creative writing stories, and it was never a chore for me. So I always loved that. And I was probably writing poems, you know, 9, 10, somewhere around that time, just kind of writing poetry, not like calling myself a poet, but just writing poetry because I just loved writing. And it was interesting when I was going to school at Rutgers University. I'm here in LA, and I have been for some years, but prior to that, I was over on the East Coast in early years, North Carolina, and then up in New Jersey. But when I was going to Rutgers University, I was studying drums in New York City, and I took this writing course towards the end of my time at Rutgers, and it was like a prose fiction class, but like for like the last week of the class, the professor had us do poetry, and I was just like, yes, I just felt more at home with that.
Did you see yourself as a prose writer up until that point?
I liked writing, you know, I liked writing, and I wouldn't necessarily say that I considered myself a prose writer. I just really liked writing. And I remember she sort of gave me one of these backhanded compliment. She sort of came up to me at the end of the semester and sort of gave me this pat on the shoulder and said, "You're a much better poet than you are a fiction writer."
Well, then, you're right. That was sort of... Stick with poetry, so, kid.
Yeah. So, you know, it wasn't long after... And I agreed with her, you know. It was poet, like... Yeah, fiction is a lot more labored for me. I like it, and I really admire really good fiction writers, and I love reading fiction, but it's pulling teeth for me trying to get through that entire process. But after I finished Rutgers, I pretty much packed my drums up in my car, headed out to California.
Can I stop you there? What's the drums?
I started playing drums when I was in college. And
so you had a musical career too?
Yeah, definitely. And I sort of say that because it's going to lend itself to my performance.
I'm seeing the connection already.
Yeah. So I moved out to California. I ended up in San Francisco.
Oh,
and
my
I was,
God.
You know, playing drums in bands, well, one band really, and you know, going to all these spoken word readings. And I was telling this story to someone last night where, you know, this old guard woman, you know, who had been sort of like, you know, from kind of knew a lot of the beats during that time. She kind of took me under her wing. She's like, you got a lot of energy, kid. You know, I think you could do well for yourself. Let me introduce you to some people. And she introduced me actually to Bob Kaufman before he passed away.
Wow.
She had all these stories about Gregory Corso. You know, she's like, "Yeah, Gregory Corso sleep on my couch," and you know, all these crazy things. But and so anyway, as I started performing poetry more, well, you know, performing music and poetry, and one would sort of feed the other. And with the drums, the rhythm of playing the drums, I found started bleeding into my spoken word performance with not only how I would deliver the words live, but also how I would construct phrases in my head to put them down on the page. You know, you
Fantastic.
Mentioned the thing about alliteration before, and I think a lot of that definitely comes from
percussion.
Percussion, exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah,
for
it does.
Percussion and how I hear words and how the words feel in my body. So, yeah, those things definitely tie
So
in.
Are you calling yourself a poet at this point?
Oh, sorry. Yes, I think I didn't really start calling myself a poet until probably when I was in San Francisco and I was, you know, performing a bit and other people were calling me a poet. I think I didn't get comfortable calling myself a poet until other people started calling me a poet for a while.
That's so true of a lot of artists.
Yeah, and then it felt a little bit more comfortable to sort of wear that and to feel it. Oh, and one other thing I wanted to say, I pretty much like memorize my work. I don't like to perform with papers in my hand because I use my body a lot. And again, that gets to the idea with drumming, and I kind of like to move and things like that. And I saw when I lived in San Francisco, I saw Anne Waldman perform once, and she blew me away. I mean, her words, but she used her body in such a way, and I was just like, that's what I want to aspire to. Like, I want to be so on fire just like that. And I want my body to be free. I want my delivery to be that fiery and that free. And she was really a big inspiration for me to liberate myself from the paper, to just, you know, have the words not only in my mind, but to embody the words and to just be the words on stage.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is poet Rich Ferguson. His latest collection is Everything is Radiant, Between the Hates. It's out on Moontide Press. Rich, could I implore you to read a poem before long?
Yeah.
I want to make sure that we have enough time.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to hear you read them because I read them in my head, and it was I was hearing a voice, a specific kind of voice, and I just want to see how much it matches up.
Yeah, okay. That's pretty funny. Okay. I'm going to read this one. It's for my daughter, and who I love dearly, and if we have time, we can talk about my connection with her and how I was sort of late coming to fatherhood for various reasons, but it's been one of my biggest joys. Anyway, this is probably one of the first poems I wrote about her. Things about myself and the world I will and won't explain to my four-year-old daughter when she's older. First, drugs. I'll definitely discuss drugs, but I probably won't mention the time I snorted heroin in a dingy MacArthur Park hotel room, or the times I tripped on mescaline, mushrooms, ecstasy, LSD, laughing my ass off, witnessing the walls and people's faces melting, time traveling, telepathically communicating with animals, insects, trees. What I will explain to my daughter is how drugs can be both dangerous and alluring, how one can get so easily hooked on the rush, the giddiness, the floating away, how there are days when all people, all we want to do is float away. I'll teach my daughter how things like art, music, and poetry can offer a much purer sense of floating away. I'll discuss how poetry has so greatly influenced my life. That said, I probably won't mention the time I was scheduled to do a featured reading yet wound up in the hospital that day. Won't reveal how when I realized I'd be in the hospital much longer than I had expected, yanked the IV from my arm when the nurse wasn't around, scrambled into my clothes, seized a cotton ball to clot the unnerving pulse of my blood, spraying the wall, snuck out of the hospital, hailed a taxi, sped off to my feature, and rocked it. I'll teach my daughter the importance of empathy, compassion, consideration. That said, I probably won't mention the time I was blind drunk at my brother's wedding, skied naked, received a summons from the Wisconsin Water Police, even after I'd slurringly tried convincing them that if they didn't ticket me, I would take them back to L.A., make them big TV stars, a river version of Chips. I'll figure out how to describe to my daughter the utter remorse and humiliation I experienced as a teenager upon being nabbed by store security in a Kmart parking lot after I had shoplifted the soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever. I didn't even want the damn cassette. All I'd wanted was for my parents to stop fighting and not get divorced. I'll do my best to prepare my daughter for ages 13 through 19. How those years will be one great big life-affirming, soul-crushing rush of proms, relationships, acne breakups, and all the rest. I may even find the appropriate moment to offer a cautionary tale or two, how my dumbass teenage buddies and I would drive drunk, spin donuts on people's pristine lawns, jam potatoes and car tailpipes, steal road signs, all because we had no idea how to express our reckless and random hormone-fueled emotions any other way. Then I'll play for my daughter, The Who's Bob O'Reilly. We'll dance through the house celebrating and commiserating in the joys and sorrows of those coming years, loudly singing as The Who wails, Teenage Wasteland. It's only Teenage Wasteland. I'll teach my daughter honesty, justice, determination. We'll support her in maintaining a positive body image. I will confess how in high school I used an ice cube and Zippo-heated dirty sewing needle to pierce my ear, how it became an infected, swollen mess, suffered through shots and antibiotics for well over a week, all for the sake of wanting to fit in because my dumbass buddies kept telling me I would look much cooler if my ear were pierced. I'll point out to my daughter the importance of never letting anybody, including herself, bend up her aura, reshape her inner light into an unflattering shine. How certain mistakes can never be completely undone, but in the best possible circumstances, their DNA can be altered to embody subtle forms of forgiveness and grace. How our every breath and heartbeat have the potential to compose verses on air, sonnets of love when it's freshly baked, glorious stories of coyote-blooded magic, sending us roaming wild-tooth and full-moon-footed into the dense forest of the absolutely alive. I will warn my daughter that this is a world where people can hurt and heal, that there exists the goodness of strangers and the absolute cruelty of those we've considered friends, how the bitterness and anger we sometimes experience is no city for permanent refuge. In the face of it all, I will teach my daughter to wear her name proudly. Let it be a cradled murmur in the ear, bubble and luck and Attila the Hun of fun, a get-out-of-jail-free card and her own star on Hollywood Boulevard. May the mere mention of my daughter's name be a cathedral of sweet talk, hummingbird flutter, and on her most troubled days, may my daughter's name be the tears that travel in reverse to unstain her cheeks and brighten her sad, sad eyes.
That was epic. One of the great things about it is it's also universal. That sentiment of what you want to tell your children versus what you did.
Right.
Yeah. I've been there and done that. I didn't do it poetically, unfortunately, but that is a wonderful poem.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Talk to me about your daughter. How old is your daughter?
Yeah. She is four now. I mean, I actually wrote it to her when she was younger than four, but I put to my four-year-old daughter in the book because that is her age right now. And, you know, I came into fatherhood a little late because I was one of those people that was of the mindset, you know, I've got my music, I've got my writing, and if I bring a child to the world,
I'm going to lose all my mojo.
Yeah, I'm going to lose my mojo, and that was kind of how I operated for a number of years, and then eventually, you know, I had the good fortune to meet a woman that changed my mind and gave me the bravery to actually, you know, try it out and to you know, experience being a father. And it's one of the best things I've ever done. And she's, rather than closing up my life, which I had feared before, she's like opened up my life and opened up my heart in ways that I just would have never imagined prior to taking that journey.
What a great father. Now, we're going to be running out of time. I'm not going to have time to ask you. That was an epic poem. That's a great example of the poetry that's in this book, by the way, for people listening. I want to ask you a couple of things just generally. How is it for you as a poet during the year of COVID?
Well, I, you know, like so many other people who perform live or make their livelihood performing live, a buddy of mine, Butch Norton, a drummer that I sometimes perform with, he's Lucinda Williams' drummer, and you know, people like that, I feel so bad for them because that's their livelihood and they can't do that thing they so love to do. And I think that's one of the things that I, while I don't like make my quote-unquote livelihood from performing, it is something I do a lot, and that is definitely the thing that I miss the most. And, you know, were we not in COVID right now, I would be, you know, touring the country, promoting the book and things like that. And, you know, Zoom poetry readings have been fun. And, you know, in a way, Zoom has been great because when I was performing in the real world, I was limited to doing poetry readings either locally here in LA or going to a specific place like flying to New York. But with Zoom, I can be, you know, I can be sitting here at home and I can be in a poetry reading in New York or collaborating with a musician in Sweden or, you know, collaborating with a visual artist in Canada. So that's been pretty cool, but I do miss performing live a lot.
You want to see people's faces in the audience.
And feel the energy.
Yeah. And people who don't do live performances don't understand that there is an energy that you, that's palpable, that speeds you on. Yeah. Talk to me about, you're living in LA now, right?
Yes.
How is that as a muse, as a place to be a poet? Because you've got some good poems in there about LA.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if you would have, after I, you know, I said earlier that I lived in San Francisco, and after I left San Francisco, I was trying to figure out where to go to after that, and I had the man I was with in San Francisco, we had toured the States and stuff. So there were other cities I was thinking, like Austin, Texas, or Boston, or going back east to, like, you know, New York City or whatever. And I said, you know what, I'm going to go to L.A., give it a year, see how it goes. And I hated L.A. so much the first time around. I didn't even give it a year. I gave it 9 months, and I hated it so much. I bought a one-way ticket to London, and I was just like, I am so out of here. And eventually I made my way back to L.A. because I just kind of felt I needed to deal with whatever fears or blockages that were in me that chased me out of L.A. or whatever. Yep. It was about the city that made me leave. And I was like, you know what? Go back, deal with it, deal with that, you know, whatever baggage that was. And if after you deal with that, you feel like, okay, I got to leave again, but do it. Don't do it with your tail between your legs. And I came back, and I just had a much better, I had a lighter attitude about L.A. I had friends saying, you can't take L.A. so seriously. You know, it's its own sort of beast. You just kind of have to roll with it. Don't take it seriously. Just sort of take it for what it is and you know, see how you can sort of find your way into it. And the more I kind of had that sort of mindset where I wasn't closing it out, but I was letting in all these sort of eccentricities and everything, the more I really began loving it and just like, wow, this place, it's not just like the stereotype I saw when I was a young boy back in New Jersey, you know, seeing those Pepsi commercials with people playing volleyball on Venice Beach and like, I want to go there, which was what, you know, first got me out of here. But L.A. is so much more than those stereotypes. Yep. But you really do kind of have to look for it. It's not a city you can take on sort of surface level face value. You really have to go digging. And I've had the good fortune of having so many wonderful friends here, musical connections. I mean, amazingly talented people, you know, that are just everywhere in this city, but it does take time to find them. And I feel pretty blessed that I've put the time in here to have a really strong network of those people.
It's interesting how many poets I've interviewed who are from LA. And it seems like there's a really interesting community of poets in LA.
Yeah, Beyond Baroque out in Venice.
Yeah.
Richard Modiano was heading that up for some years. And yeah, there's some really, Beyond Baroque and some other places here in LA do a really good job with bringing poets together. And
cool.
Yeah.
We're completely out of time, and I still had so many questions to talk to you. So I'm gonna have to have you come back. My guest tonight has been poet Rich Ferguson. His latest collection is Everything is Radiant Between the Hates. It's on Moontide Press. Rich, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
It's really been an honor, Mark. You know, you've asked some great questions. It's really
I have a lot more, so I'm going to have you back.
Great.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.